This podcast is proud to be part of the TalkSport Fan Network.
TalkSport. Powered by fans.
The TalkSport Fan Network is proudly supported by McDelivery, bringing you the food you love. McDelivery brings a top-tier lineup of food right to your door. No matter the results, you'll always be winning with McDelivery. Order now on the McDonald's app and you'll get rewards points delivered too, so that ordering today means some tasty rewards for tomorrow. Only via app at participating restaurants. 18 plus rewards registration required. Points only on menu items, delivery fee and terms apply. See mcdonalds.com.
Welcome to the Sheffield United Way. My name is Hal and I'm delighted to welcome another guest to the channel. This is a big one that I'm very excited about. Jim Phipps, who was part of the Sheffield United Football Club furniture for a number of years and in that time undertook several different roles, which I'm sure he'll be able to tell us all about. So to talk with us about his experiences at beautiful downtown Bramall Lane, we welcome Jim Phipps to the channel. Jim, how are you doing today, sir?
Really well, thanks.
It's great to have you on. I can't believe this. It's just amazing to think someone that we saw from a distance, and now here we are linking up from a distance.
That's right. Oh, it's great to be on, and I have a great deal of regard for what you and Nick do on this channel. And it seems like how many people now are on your team? You've got the fan cam after the games, and you've got the stats guys,
Adam, a
couple of Yanks,
yeah,
and is it Bobby? I mean, it seems like there must be a small crowd of people in your bedroom, right?
There's a small army, and they all do wonderful work, and grateful for each and every one of them. We also are very grateful that you're a fan and supporter of the Sheffield United Way, something we just couldn't have dreamed of when we came up with this ridiculous idea. It is me solo today. Nick is not with us, but of course he'll be back for many more videos in the near future. So, Jim, we need to start with the big question. How did you originally come on board and work at Sheffield United?
Well, I guess the Prince and Kevin had a chance meeting in somewhere in England while he was traveling, and he came back from this travel and handed me a slide deck on Sheffield United, and from there a series of meetings. This would have been February-ish was I think the first encounter that they had, and I was involved from that point up until we did a transaction in late August, I think the 31st of August of that year. And so I was involved in sort of studying every aspect of the club, running a due diligence team, financially, technically, basically, when we got the deals negotiated with the McCabes, I was made a director of the club, which is kind of a strange place to start in football.
That's actually leading me on beautifully to my next question. I mean, how much did you know about football and Sheffield United?
As much as I know about, say, Nepal. I know they have tall mountains. I wasn't very well informed. I think the value that I was expected to add and was sort of a business side understanding, and I'm decent with people. So, I was doing a number of different things for the Prince at that time, but one of the ideas was just to help run the club from a management side. And we built an agreement system that did not require very much work from the board. It sort of, because, you know, when we came in, there was an incumbent owner. We set things up so that most of the decisions were made by management. So people like to have the belief that the board is in there fiddling with everything. And the design of the program was essentially to not fiddle with things and to have professional managers both in the front office and on the touchline and to allow them to do their thing.
Makes sense.
It wasn't like I was coming in to be the football expert. If that were true, the prince is a football man, and he would not have sent me to do that job. So.
But you then, of course, got a chance to experience Sheffield, the city, the place. You didn't stay in America where we're speaking to you now. What did you make of the city of Sheffield?
Early impressions, super warm people. So I think the first blade other than Kevin McCabe that I met was a gentleman who is with the Handsworth Blades, Boothie, and he later passed away, I think, while traveling to see some footy in Poland. But he was sort of the first Sheffield United fan, for the first Blade who wasn't in ownership that I met. And then just from there, every single thing. I mean, it was an amazing – it was being involved in the club was like it was like one part ministry or something, where you're just taking care of people.
Yeah. You know?
And there are all kinds of things happening in people's lives, good things, bad things. And people were very happy to have they wanted the club to be a part of their great losses and of their great wins and of their, you know, the marriages and deaths. And it was just an amazing thing. And I felt like I was very much a part of the place. I think that the first match that I saw was, let's see.
Was it gone?
I'm just going to swear.
Right, but, good. Family channel.
We'll keep it PG. it was the first match of that 2013 season. So was that Notts County?
Yeah, that would have been the 2-1 win.
Yes. And so, but I think that the feeling that Sheffield was, as it had been described to me, more of a village than a city in terms of the way it felt, a very large village, but it had warmth, and that it also had this passion, you know. And of course, one of the criteria when we went out shopping for football clubs is we wanted a club that took the club, you know, as a religion. And I suppose that the first time I was sitting in the stands and wasn't sitting for long when the crowd started singing the Greasy Chip Buddy. And I troubled myself to learn it before going to that first match.
Good.
And when it just started off, it was loud. It was a hair standing up on the back of the neck kind of thing.
Well, it's different, isn't it? You know, because you're an American, and obviously viewers know I love my American sports, and there aren't really similar things that happen before a game in American sports. There are traditions, of course. You know, if you go to a Chicago Cubs game, take me out to the ball game and all that. It's not quite the same at the start, where you'll get a burst of music and then the crowd will continue the rest of the song. It's like nothing I would imagine you'd ever experienced before.
No, and the singing throughout a match and the banter between the home and away crowd is not really replicated in any American sport. And so I've seen a range of passion in stadiums as I've traveled around watching football now. And probably the only thing that was remotely similar was listening to what could probably not fairly be called banter between the Fenerbahce and Galatasaray fans.
Oh, gosh. Wow.
that's more than banter. That's
something else. But it was, one can only imagine.
I think when I went to that game, I felt the ever-present sense that anything could happen.
So, and you, I would imagine, were supporting Fenerbahce with the links to Sheffield United. Yeah.
Yeah. Who are those other guys?
Exactly.
Yeah, so those were great experiences in sort of early experiences in my life with football. So
your fandom, which of course has increased, and does your family also take an interest in Sheffield United?
Yeah, I think we're all Blades, and I think I've got a couple of brothers who still track along, and of course here in the household, it's part of the required articles of faith. So. We are all we're all into it. But we take time on whatever day or whatever hour the matches are on to find a way to watch.
Yeah, I mean, you're really into it. Let's have a look at the T-shirt that you're representing right now, the John Brayford. Yes. With your own slogan.
So, exactly. Not, some people regard it as my great folly. I've described, I love John Brayford, right?
But we love John Brayford.
The thing is about that transaction, of course, is that that transaction was done the way all the other transactions were, by the front line, by the front office and touchline management. And I didn't do anything but say, I love John Brayford.
Yeah, everyone associates you with that transfer, a transfer that, let's be honest, all us Blades wanted to happen at the time it happened. So I don't think anyone could call that folly.
Yeah, and it didn't work out, right, the way that everyone wanted. But one thing that was true was that John gave up a great deal of weekly value to come join us, you know, and he gave his heart. There was an unfortunate series of events. He got injured. He got played out of position for most of the time he was with us on contract, you know, as our own player. And we didn't get really a chance to see the John Brayford who had been with us on the loan spell, just because of, you know, the defense was broken and it never got addressed under Nigel Clough, and it never got addressed under the other Nigel. And but it just didn't get addressed. And so, John ended up getting played out of position, and I don't think he was, I don't think he made that transition. He's not really built for that other job. And he got really seriously injured, and it was just went poorly. But what a great guy, and a person who like me fell sort of instantly in love with Sheffield and the way our fans operate.
He did love Sheffield, the city. Yeah, he told us that. We had him, of course, on the channel. Yeah. And he said his favorite time was playing at Bramall Lane, which is incredible when you think that he didn't actually make that many appearances for us when you compare it with teams like Derby and Burton Albion. He also said, if people haven't watched that video, do check it out, but I will just leave you with one thought. He said that he would have liked to have played in that three where Chris Basham ended up playing as Chris Wilder took over and we converted to that three at the back with the two wing backs. He didn't want to be a right wing back. He wanted to be a centre back, and he wanted to play just on that right hand side. Of course, Basham did rather well there, but it would have been interesting to see what John Brayford could have done in that setup.
Yeah. And of course by the time Chris Wilder came, he came to us at a great lot, personal loss to himself. But in terms of our wage structure then in League One, he was pricey still. And so when you're the pricey ticket and you're looking to sort of create a squad with limited resources, you're in some danger, you know, being the first to go. And I felt like it didn't work for John like John wanted it to work, or like any of the rest of us wanted it to work. And I have nothing but respect for the guy. So, yeah. And I still think he's not just any fullback.
No, he's also a Viking these days. You've seen his beard. Wow. It's impressive. Now we talk from your greatest folly to your personal highlights. Let's talk purely positives. If you had to pick some highlights from your time, what would you choose?
Well, the first time I actually the Villa match in the FA run in 2013-14, I went down to Heathrow and picked up the Prince at the airport, and we drove up to Villa and Aston Villa, and we went up to the director's area, and I said my hellos, and then I excused myself and went down around and sat up top on the I don't remember the side and the name of the side in that, or of the stand at that stadium, but I went up and just sat with some friends amongst the Blades fans, and experiencing the match that way, you know, in the director's box, you can't really enjoy the match in the normal way. You know, you have to do this. You know, you're wearing a tie. It's just awful, right? So, I hate ties. So anyway, it was that type of experience was a little bit unnatural for me, and so it was more organic. And then I made a point of doing that at all the matches I could get away with it at, but that was great. And then the singing at the Charlton match, and then I took my parents and brought my family over for the semifinal, and that was unbelievably fun. And I converted my mom and dad to a sport they thought was, you know, akin to watching tennis, you know, watching grass grow. So, and my parents, you know, my dad came away, you know, thinking, wow, you know, he'd really missed something. So
8 goals in every game, there must be.
Well, and I think that moment in that match that was just, it was an unbelievable feeling. It was like every single Blade's heart in that, you know, in Wembley was in unison, and the clapping that went on from their last goal until all of the players were off the pitch was, you know, everyone was standing and singing, and it didn't matter that we were going to lose. What mattered is that we had, I guess we'd broken some barriers. We scored at Wembley, but also the lads had just put on a display of, you know, that involved so much heart. And we had been the Giant Slayers that season. And it had been kind of a mixed bag of a start in our, you know, share of ownership in the club, in the league play. But it also, I think that run fueled some long undefeated streaks, and it fueled some, you know, great hopes. And I just, that was great. Yeah, I think those are probably that. From that FA Cup, I took a lot of joy. I also, it's an odd sort of highlight, but I really, really admire David Weir. You know, he gets slated, you know, and the start to the season that he had with us was an abomination. It wasn't entirely his fault. I mean, he's having players, some of them not so fantastic, thrown at him like right and left after the deal gets done. We start spending money to try to do things that didn't get done during the summer. Before our deal got done, we'd sold off McDonald, who had been a significant part of David's plans. But when the decision was taken to make a change, it was me that went to talk to David. And there is not a more class individual that I've met, I think, ever. He was as calm and collected, and you know, he had no venom in him. And you know, he's a guy. I think someday he's going to be. I think he's on his way there now, but I think he's going to be a super manager. But I think it was not the ideal circumstances, and because he was new to club management, I'd guess that he hadn't yet learned that there's a certain level of resistance that a manager has to put up to boardroom nonsense. So,
good way of putting it.
Or front office nonsense, or whatever, you know, whatever it was. So I think that was a great, you know, it's, for me, I haven't had a chance to be in contact with him much, but I've tried to track him through his journeys through football, and I admire him, and knowing him was a highlight. Those are some positives. I have to say, there's one Blade who made me the godfather of his child. There were funerals and weddings and opportunities to sort of be a part of people's lives, and to be taken in like that is more than amazing. So it just. But it's so typical, I think, of Sheffield. It's like you're all the way in or you're all the way out. But the assumption is that you're all the way in. You know, you're accepted first, and then if you screw it up, you get the stick. And of course, if you're in the boardroom of a football club, it doesn't matter. You're getting the stick.
Oh, yeah, yeah. I would never want to be anywhere near a boardroom at my beloved club if I had all the money in the world.
I remember somebody tweeted me something, you know, sometime after, maybe within a month or so of when I had left the club. And I remember responding to him just saying, well, I'm not the pissing post anymore. but yeah, I mean, it's just, it's those types of experiences. I think another thing that my parents were surprised by was the, after the match, we're just walking back to get transportation out of the general area and back into London where we were staying. And they were surprised at how the passion continued. You know, it was before we got to the stadium and after we left, and until there were no blades in sight. But while there was a blade in sight, there was a passionate discussion to be had. So,
oh, yeah,
and the feeling was amazing that day. So
I think one of the things I know Blades fans want to thank you for is we'd had a little bit of it with Mick Rooker in terms of someone who was very fan forward thinking and very amenable to the fans and actually kind of a voice when we didn't always know what was going on. And then you became on social media, which we hadn't experienced because Mick was great, but he was one of those people that would do it on maybe a forum or via email, or you could just pick up the phone. He was brilliant face to face as well. You were someone that even if people never met, you were amenable and available on something like Twitter. And it was just something that we'd never experienced before. Was that something that you were told to do, or is that just you and your personality?
More instinct, and also a little bit more American sports. It's really not, I think we're not, at least clubs as clubs are more engaged. I think we do have amongst our big organization leadership a tendency to avoid interaction. But I think one of the things I saw in the club when I arrived was a kind of siege mentality about fan interactions. Like, tell them nothing. You'll make a rod for your own back. The idea was not to share information. It was to control information. And, you know, there's information that needs controlling, but there's also a great deal that you can do to let people know that you get it and that you're listening and that you're somehow available. You know, what I think I would say now is that I think the club has done like a complete 180 in terms of the way the club engages on social media. It's out there. It's funny. They have the team that's doing, the creative team that's doing the communications for Sheffield United is great. And I think that, it's still true that when we're in a hard spot, that sometimes it seems a little long between, information from the board level. And so I think people sort of, what doesn't get said gets imagined. And so sometimes the bow wave of resistance that will build up in the club to whatever the board is doing or whatever front office management is doing comes by leaving people to guess a little long. But I would still say, the club is, 1,000 times better at communicating than it had been. And that's something I think I don't claim any credit for it, but I do see that it has enormous value. So to me, it's a big deal, because if you're that connected to a club, to not be spoken to is that's hard. That's like some sort of sentence.
Yeah, it's like a punishment. Well, we're doing our bit with our little channel in the corner, trying to bring as much misinformation. No, just to bring as much accurate information as possible. So now we've got to be careful with this question, but what stories can you tell us from your time at the club about players? That's always what people are most interested in.
Oh, I think I'd want to be careful too. Well, there are players that I really admire, and I don't think I could give an adequate list, but I'll talk about a few. I thought Connor Cody was just a class human being. And I would love to have seen us be able to afford him. And he's obviously gone on to have a great career since, but, and to be a leader on the club. That is not a surprise. Great, great guy. Michael Doyle. He was superb. You know, of course, he was all heart. He had whatever limitations he had as a player, but he really meant for the best to happen for our club. And I, you know, he's he was a great example to me of a person who really loved the shirt and the badge and played for, you know, kind of left everything out there every time. And let's see.
What about when we mentioned Michael Doyle? As you know, I reached out to you on Twitter the first time we sort of connected, which was about Michael Doyle. And I think the reason I got in touch was that he very much left seemingly via the back door. There was no fanfare. And he'd played a lot of games. And you might remember me questioning why the club hadn't done something maybe to say thank you to him.
Yeah, and I think sometimes the club was a little classless about this, that, or thoughtless about it, probably more thoughtless than classless. But so Michael left in that, in the in-between, between, well, he actually left just after Nigel, or his was it his contract ended? Just before Nigel Adkins arrived, but there was a chance that he could be brought back. And Michael and I had some exchanges about that. And, you know, I told him what I told you about how we did business. I don't make those decisions. I leave them to the, touchline management and front office management, but I'll communicate the question about, you know, and communicate your desire to serve the club more if it can be done. And that wasn't the, you know, that wasn't what I think at that time. Of course, Nigel Adkins is coming into a squad of 43 players or something like that. I mean, he had a real challenge on his hands. And so he was the ranks were bloated. And that makes, you know, when you have too many players, it makes the players unhappy, right? Because it makes it harder to get in the side. It makes it, you know, you've got your career that you want to manage. You want to keep, you want to be on the pitch playing football, not watching from the stands or even just subbing. You want to actually make appearances and do your thing. And so that we, I think we had a fairly unhappy set of players and that, and Michael, you know, he was one that wanted to play for the club and it wasn't to be. And I think just simply for reasons of numbers, but yeah, I feel like the failure to give him a goodbye of some kind to acknowledge his service was probably not out of meanness or spite, but just out of the normal level of frenetic activity that's happening in a football club over the summer. And I'm not aware of any of there being any malice of any kind. But I do think occasionally we would fail to say things that should have been said. And I think that was one of those cases. But just in case he ever hears this recording, Michael Doyle, thank you. You're awesome. And I think that we all, you know, would have felt the same. And there'll be, of course, his critics amongst the supporters, because that's what we do. but I think everyone recognizes that he put his heart into every match, whether he was up to the task on the day. One thing you could be sure of is when he showed up, it would always, the players would come through the boardroom. When they came through the boardroom, he was spent. And, yeah. You know, so
I'll say more than that.
Right. So I think exactly. In the Sheffield United sort of, rules, you know, for playing with us, you know, you never call us massive and you always leave it all on the pitch.
Yeah, quite right. And we'll make sure that he sees your thank you. You know us, Jim. We always try and follow through with our promises. So I was interrupting you there when you were about to reel off, I'm sure, other players with fascinating background stories?
Well, I think I'm really cautious about this because I would only want to be positive. There were some players who were surprisingly bad sports behind the scenes, but why would I talk about that? and then I just think there were stories that evolved along the way that were profoundly embarrassing to me. You know, we brought in a player who maybe wasn't worthy of our club. That was early days. We had a player who was not getting what he wanted from football management, and so was kind of menacing the club. That kind of thing. It belongs behind closed doors, and it will stay there. So. I would have to say that this isn't a player comment, but I think that transition from what happened at the end of that season where Nigel Atkins ended up leaving the club, not Nigel Atkins, but Nigel Clough, was really painful to me. It was a difficult transition. It was hard to see that relationship and he had a very respectable record with us. And in terms of the win loss percentages, oh wait, that sounds like something from Ted Lasso.
Are you saying then that Nigel Clough was a good man, an honest man, a decent guy, and someone that was obviously there, but therefore very difficult to let go?
Yeah. And he was, there were things about his management that I thought could improve, but I also did not like, you know, I hate to send away people who I think are successful and who can be worked with, but there were, that's one of those things where there are different views on a board and different ways things went, but I usually handled the bad news. And so, and I also, you know, was the one who ran the effort to try to, keep his tenure going. But I would say I really admired him. It was he is a very unique person, and he offered things to the football club that were are unusual. By the same token, we just were not. There were some things that we were not getting right, and we needed to figure out how we could make improvements. But I don't think there was a change coming in approach. So anyway, but I really loved the way he operated, and he had some of the characteristics that we admired so much in Chris Wilder in terms of being. You know, he was kicking every ball, and he was, he was the kind of guy who was passionate about the game. He wasn't just wearing a suit, standing on the sideline impassively, thinking about who knows what. I mean, I think he was there kicking every ball, and I thought the world of him. And I'm attracted to people. Whether I like their temperaments or their personalities or their manner, whatever it is, I'm attracted to people who are passionate about what they're doing. It's really hard not to like somebody who's in love with what they're doing. And so, that was a hard transition, and I have, admiration for him and for what he's done also since leaving our club. I think he's a terrific guy, and it's not a surprise to me that he spent so much time at Burton. I remember the chairman of Burton coming when he came to our club and telling me what a special person Nigel Clough was. And that was, I think it was borne out in our experience. And we all lived the cup run, and we all lived through that sort of rebound on what had been a terrible season in the beginning.
Absolutely. Yeah. Ben Robinson, chairman of Burton Albion, and by all accounts, a very good chap. So for you at the end, Jim, how did it all end with United?
Well, I think this is a great topic, and I'll be careful, but I'll be honest. It's not a secret that Kevin McCabe didn't like me, and he had spent period of months, by then years, bad-mouthing me to the Prince and trying to undermine literally everything I did. We were kind of a one step forward, two steps back, kind of an organization at the top. And I couldn't adequately convey to His Royal Highness how difficult that relationship was, and not for personal reasons, because I don't really run things on the basis of how I feel about a person. Our interests in that relationship were, I think, constantly at threat by the way our partner wanted to do things. And it was tense. And of course, I figured at the end that the Prince would need to work directly with Kevin for a season to figure out who his partner was, because there was a period of time when the Prince couldn't be very involved at all because of a spell of government service as essentially a minister of sport. And so it was just my relationship to manage, and it didn't go well. And I think one of the things, I was pondering this before, but, Kevin was not accustomed to being told no, or finding that somebody disagreed with him. And I was willing to disagree with Kevin. And that really turned him against me. And I thought, well, the best thing to do is for the health of the club, for the Prince's own well-being, would be for him to make his own judgments about what to do in this relationship. And the Prince, then ran the relationship himself for a spell, and we know what followed from that. But I will say that not gloating, but gratifying, that the clauses that I negotiated in the agreements resulted in getting the right owner when Kevin overplayed his hand and sort of lowballed the Prince on the assumption that the Prince had no money. People have said that a lot. There'd been a whispering campaign run along those lines, and for whatever reason, the other side of the equation came to believe their own rhetoric, and then they got stung when the Prince flipped Kevin's proposal on him, and the rest is history. But it was unhappy days. So part of my departure involved the difficulty in my relationship with Kevin, and part of it, and I think I even said it in a public radio interview, not about my leaving the club, but just that, when people reach this level in organizations, they typically have learned how to stand up for themselves. So, and to, stake out a position based on principles, I'm sure that Kevin would describe me as stubborn and unruly or whatever, but it doesn't matter. That's all behind us now. I would say that I said publicly, and I meant it too, that I left the club because I had disappointed the club, right? I wanted my leadership to result in our getting up sooner. We were in a better position, but not greatly better position when I left than when I started. And so I think it's also important when you care about performance to, to bow out if the results you're getting aren't matching, the desired results. So you know, I do feel like I'm responsible for my part in it, and I'm glad to, wear whatever shame I deserve, for those results. And I'm also happy to acknowledge what came next, which was the appointment of somebody who turned out. I don't know if anyone could have expected it when it started. I guess if you looked at the record, at Chris Wilder's record before in bringing clubs and leveling clubs up in leagues below, you might think he'd be capable of it. And I have great admiration for what happened next. And I didn't know that it was going to happen, and I didn't have a say in its happening. I'm so happy that it did happen. And I think it was just great for the club. And it's given us a period in our history, which everyone will always remember with fondness and gratitude and admiration. And it's not likely to see that sort of connection between manager and club, very frequently. When do you have a manager who's born and bred a Blade, and is, how often has it happened in our history? Right, it's happened, but it's, the results, the passion, the sliding in with the players after goals, and the, all of it, the Chrissy Wilder, he's one of our own. All of that is very special, and while I had nothing to do with it, I'm very happy that it happened, and I think I'm also sad that it ended, but that's where we are, and I think we're off to to something new that's starting to take on a special feeling.
Well, let's hope so. Yeah, I mean, you're going to make me cry if we keep talking about Chris Wilder and everything he achieved and that special connection. You have, of course, continued to have a special connection with the fans, and in many ways, I'm sure it's a lot easier now being able to just watch as a fan. Jim Phipps, I think that's a great place to leave it. You've been giving up your time. We have been incredibly grateful to you for doing that. Again, I'll say it. We're very, very glad that you support the channel as you do. And thank you for finally being on it and telling us your story. It's been fascinating.
Great. Up the Blades.
Away days are great, but there's nothing quite like playing at home. The same goes for McDonald's. Maximize your home ground advantage with McDelivery. Order now on the McDonald's app. At participating restaurants, 18 plus serving times, delivery fee and terms apply. See mcdonalds.com.
This podcast is proud to be part of the TalkSport Fan Network.
TalkSport. Powered by fans.